Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, March 23, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss oral argument in the Little Sisters of the Poor case, also known as the Zubik case, also known as the contraceptive mandate case, argued this morning in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome back to our program today Roger Severino. He's the Director of the DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society at the Heritage Foundation here in Washington, D.C. He kindly attended oral argument this morning. He's going to begin with opening remarks of about 20 minutes, give us some background on the Affordable Care Act, the contraceptive mandate itself, the case, and then the oral argument earlier today. But then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind when we get to that portion of the program. But for now, the opening remarks, Mr. Severino, go right ahead.
Thank you very much, Dean. Glad to be on. First contrast, I was at the Hellerstedt oral argument, and the feeling in the court and outside was very tense. This was very different. You had a bunch of nuns outside the court singing hymns, and it just kind of changed the tenor of the whole day. I don't know if some of that bled into the courtroom, but it just did feel different. And another notable thing is that Justice Scalia's seat doesn't have the black cloth over it. His seat has been removed, and they've reshuffled the justices and their seating arrangement. So it was kind of poignant to see that, you know, Justice Scalia, the stalwart of conservatism, you know, is not there to argue this very big case when he was part of the 5-4 majority in Hobby Lobby. A bit about the background on the case itself. This is about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and one of its mandates. So the law that Congress passed required that preventative services be covered, but it didn't specify what counted as preventative services. Through regulatory rulemaking, a third party determined that preventative services would require coverage of contraceptives, of abortion-inducing drugs that work to induce abortions, like Plan B, like Ella, and also to cover sterilization. And it had to be covered without a copay, the argument being that if you have no copay, you'll end up saving money for the insurers because you will avoid and delay pregnancy, which could get expensive. So that's how it was sold, and it was done through regulatory rulemaking. And as you might imagine, because it dealt with issues so sensitive to life, many religious employers objected, and they objected at the rulemaking phase. And also, as the cases started to wind out after the rules were finalized, there was an exemption offered by the administration, which covered churches and integrated auxiliaries based on a provision of the IRS code. And there was another couple very big exemptions. One was an exemption for small businesses under 50 employees. And then there was an exemption for grandfathered plans. This was based on the, if you like your insurance, you could keep it. So corporations that did not change their plans were able to keep it without having to cover contraceptives and Plan B and other objectionable drugs. This included Exxon, Chevron, and Pepsi. So in sum total, about one out of three Americans were not covered by this contraceptive mandate. Religious institutions, however, some of them were covered. The ones that didn't cover as a church or an integrated auxiliary, like the Little Sisters of the Poor, they're not an integrated order under a bishop, so they actually would not qualify as being religious enough under this exemption. They objected to it, and in the meanwhile, Hobby Lobby was objecting as well. So this was the for-profit, closely held business that did not want to provide the set of these drugs under their plans for their employees. That case went all the way up to the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision. Under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the court held that it did impose a substantial burden on the religious beliefs of the owners and operators of Hobby Lobby. And interestingly, one of the deciding factors was that they pointed to an alternative enforcement mechanism that the administration had promulgated for religious nonprofits. So it said if you could provide an alternative mechanism for this group why didn't you at least offer that to Hobby Lobby to see if it would have gotten got rid of the substantial burden? However, it withheld the question as to whether or not that proposal itself could impose a substantial burden on those religious nonprofits. So it's very interesting. It said you're providing an exemption, at least offer it more broadly, but we don't know if that exemption is going to be good enough ultimately. And that's where things stayed until the Little Sisters of the Poor and various other religious groups objected, and their cases wound up on this alternative mechanism. The mechanism is, the administration calls it an accommodation, and they say it does so because the religious nonprofit is not required to directly pay for the objectionable drugs and devices. So they are required to submit a form, Form 700, identifying that they are an objecting institution, identifying their third-party administrator, their plan administrator, and giving them contact information so that it would authorize them to issue the, authorize the government to then issue the contraceptives and drugs through a third party and require that third party to bear the costs. Now, money is fungible, and whether or not that actually means the religious institution is not paying for it indirectly or directly or not, that's not so much the issue anymore. The Little Sisters and the other petitioners argue it's not really about the money. It's about the complicity in the provision of these objectionable drugs and devices. So the argument that was actually raised by Paul Clement, who argued for Little Sisters, he said, imagine if the Little Sisters have an office and the government said, we're going to require you to dedicate some space in that office to open up a Title X clinic, which provides free contraceptives to your employees. And don't worry, we'll pay for the contraceptives, and we'll even pay you rent for that space. And that's the argument they said would violate their religious beliefs. That would impose a substantial burden, because even if they're not paying for it, they're still cooperating in that provision. They're still part of the mechanism, and they're, and this word was used multiple times, their infrastructure is being hijacked. So that was the framework that the petitioners were saying, this is a hijack. Now, why does this matter for the governing law? Well, the governing law is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was passed in the wake of the Employment Division versus Smith decision, which is a Scalia decision, in fact, which changed the test under the Free Exercise Clause. The test used to be essentially that if a substantial burden was imposed on people, under the Free Exercise Clause, the government would have to justify that burden by compelling government interest using the least restrictive means possible, the familiar strict scrutiny test. Employment Division versus Smith said that's not going to be the case anymore. The test is shifted when there's a neutral law of general applicability and doesn't directly target a religious institution, et cetera, for disfavor like discrimination. Then essentially rational basis applies, absent some unique circumstances or exceptions. And that was reacted to by Congress very harshly. They responded with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which restored the substantial burden test as a federal statute. It originally applied to the states. In Bernie, it limited it just to the federal government. And that's why this is at issue now, because these are federal laws and federal regulations. And so the substantial burden test is what is directly at play. So interestingly, Justice Kagan was saying, well, she rehashed the Smith argument. She said, isn't this going to just open up a can of worms where every religious objector will essentially be a law unto themselves, and they get to decide what they object to, and then the government will have to deal with an unending number of exemption requests, and they'd have to tailor them to every single one. To which the petitioners, I think it was Clement, who said, that's right, but that was what was decided after Smith, and Congress rejected the Smith test. So you could relitigate Smith, but it was already decided by Congress that they would not adopt the Smith test, and they would stick to the Sherbert versus Verner test that preceded it for substantial burden. Right out of the gate, so the liberals use the analogy that this is not really a substantial burden by analogizing to conscientious objectors, and this was Kagan and Sotomayor picked up on this. They argued that essentially petitioners are objecting to the process of objecting. So if you're a conscientious objector in war, you're required at the very least to say, I don't want to fight. But what if that same objector said, I don't want to tell you I don't want to fight because I know that will trigger you finding somebody else to take my place? And to which Clement responded, that's not the case. Here, if you really want to have a correct analogy, it would be that the conscientious objector would be required by the government to point out the precise person who will take his or her place. And that's more akin to what the little sisters are required to do by filling out these forms, identifying their third-party administrator. And without that little form, which the government tried to say is just a form, no contraceptive coverage would flow to their employees. So the petitioners repeatedly said, if it's not that big a deal, then why are you requiring the little sisters to sign the form and identify their third-party administrator? On pain of fines to the tune of $70 million, that's the substantial burden that the petitioners were talking about, that it is the fine of that extraordinary amount that really shows you how burdensome this is. If the government really didn't care about it, if it really had alternative mechanisms that it was more than willing to pursue, it wouldn't be punishing the little sisters for not complying. So that was on the substantial burden point. It surprisingly, on the lower courts, we had a lot of victories at the district court level for the religious institutions and a lot of losses at the appellate court level. But you still had a circuit split. I think it was Eighth Circuit ruled in favor of the religious institutions. So you had that split, and those circuit courts were ruling all on the issue of substantial burden. They all said that this does not impose a substantial burden on the religious nonprofits. This is a case of attenuation. So that word attenuation kept coming up in the lower courts, that there are too many steps removed from the actual provision of contraceptives. This is insurance, this is a third-party administrator, this is a regulatory scheme. And the second point they would make is that there's no burden because religious nonprofits just have the facts wrong. They are not the ones that are legally responsible for the flow of contraceptive coverage. It is actually the regulatory scheme that's responsible. It's the federal government that's responsible. To which Justice Kennedy responded, so you're saying that they're not complicit and don't worry about it? And he said that almost sarcastically. He very quickly, when he was questioning Solicitor General Verrilli, he questioned and he said, are you conceding that there's a substantial burden? And just right out of the gate, he took practically the substantial burden question off the table, and saying you can't really question their sincerity and you can't question their views of how this operates. And no matter what the government says about it, it is the religious institution's view of the matter that carries the day, to the extent that they are actually required to act. So they are actually, the little sisters of poor and others, they're required to do something. It's not simply an instance where the government does an action and the petitioners object. The government is requiring the religious nonprofits to do something, and that's send a notice and notify them of their plan administrator and give information, and that is what triggers all sorts of flow of objectionable devices. So it really seemed as if Justice Kennedy was not having it. He was not. It didn't seem like he was willing to entertain the substantial burden question. And again, this is where all the action was at the lower courts. But most of the action before the Supreme Court was on the secondary questions. So once you get through a substantial burden, so you establish a substantial burden on the religious exercise under RFRA, then the question moves, can the government prove that it had a compelling governmental interest that was enforced in the least restrictive means possible? And there was much discussion as to whether or not there was a compelling governmental interest. As mentioned earlier, churches and integrated auxiliaries were exempt. Small businesses under 50 were exempt. Grandfathered plans were exempt. That's one out of three people in the country were not covered by the contraceptive mandate. There was a lot of back and forth on this very point as to how you can have so many exemptions yet still say you have a compelling governmental interest. And the chief, he actually made it a more precise point. He said the compelling government interest can't be that it's the provision of contraceptives generally. It is the compelling interest in providing contraceptives through the plans of these religious nonprofits. That's really what it comes down to. And pointing out to the fact that there are all sorts of alternatives that could have been pursued. Petitioners are very clear. Noel Francisco also argued for petitioners in saying that if the government has all sorts of exemptions and it says that it could fulfill its compelling governmental interest in providing free contraceptives to all sorts of people that are exempt, why not do that same mechanism, that same plan, whatever the government's doing there, do it for us? Why are you picking on us? Why are we special? Why are we different? Why is it that you need these religious nonprofits to fulfill this interest when you're finding a way to fulfill this interest somehow for the big corporations, for the church plans, and for the small businesses that are exempt? The counters were verily said, well, we had grandfathering for the ADA, and we had exemptions under Title VII for discrimination. Small businesses are exempt from that. So you could actually have exemptions, and that doesn't undermine your compelling governmental interest. And Breyer picked up on this and said, well, the tax code is chock full of exemptions. And that we don't say that the administration of the tax code is not a compelling governmental interest. And he was essentially saying, if we accept your argument, then we're going to get all sorts of tax protesters coming forward. Nobody mentioned that the Lee case should have handled that, unfortunately, but I think that does handle it. But in any event, that was the interplay on the level of exemptions and how they matter. Petitioners came back and they said, well, the exemptions matter very much. Even if you set aside the grandfathering and even if you set aside the business, you can't have a rational explanation for exempting only churches and integrated auxiliaries. Under an obscure IRS provision, HHS picked this as their dividing line when it has nothing to do with employee coverage. And in fact, if you qualify, you don't even have to object to contraceptive coverage. You automatically get an exemption in this narrow band. And the question is, why would you exempt the archdiocese and Catholic Charities when they're there, but not an independent standing Catholic Charities when they do essentially the same thing, when they're both entirely religious? The Little Sisters of the Poor are sisters, nuns, essentially. And it was very much a discussion as to why is it that you would pick only this one slice for exemption and favored treatment and not the other? On the least restrictive means, we had the question of why is it that you're requiring this program pass through this order of nuns in this particular way when you could put people on the exchanges? So there's a significant discussion on why the exchanges are viable from the petitioner side and why the exchanges are not viable coming from the opposers. So on the point of the exchanges, Sotomayor seemed, and Ginsburg to another degree, seemed to say, well, why are you going to force women to do this alternative mechanism when the whole point of it is to make it easily flow? And Verrilli said, this is supposed to be seamless coverage. And that's the entire point. If you require women to go through an extra step and go on the exchanges, it's just a regulatory hassle. And the very reason they're requiring the religious nonprofits to take part in this mechanism is to overcome inertia. And that's essentially what we're saying. That's a compelling government interest, to overcome inertia, because benefits will not take advantage of it otherwise. And if you're creating an obstacle by making them go to the exchanges, then you're defeating the very purpose of requiring the coverage to go through this alternative mechanism. And Alito very quickly pointed out, well, are you saying that the exchanges are unworkable, which got a laugh? It was essentially hearkening back to all the glitches and errors with the rollout of the Obamacare exchanges. So I got a few chuckles. And Alito followed up by saying, well, you argue that you have all sorts of restrictions that prevent you from doing an alternate mechanism for providing free contraceptive coverage. And Leto said, isn't it not within the executive power to waive the penalties for noncompliance if somebody violates one of these regulations and they provide the contraceptive coverage anyway? And that was essentially an allusion to the government's view, that the broad view of executive power in, for example, the immigration context. If you're willing to stop enforcement of laws in that context, Alito was essentially saying, why aren't you willing to stop enforcement in this context if it were useful in the flow of free contraceptives without requiring the Little Sisters and their cooperation? And finally, I'll end with how it was closed. Clement has a very good rebuttal. He raised the point that Title VII was a much better dividing line for what counts as a religious institution, and the obscure tax provision certainly was not. He cited the Mary Mother of the Eucharist brief on that point. And then he closed by saying that this is not about conscientious objection, it is about conscientious collaboration. And I think that encapsulated the arguments quite well. It is about forced collaboration in a scheme that people of good conscience, goodwill, and religious faith cannot agree to. And if they do, if they don't, they'll be fined to the tune of $70 million. So with that, I welcome any of your questions. I didn't cover everything, but I do want to hear from all the listeners.
Thank you so much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you can indicate so by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got plenty of time left for questions, and as Mr. Severino suggested, some uncovered territory. So push the star button, then the pound button if you have a question. We've got one caller on the line, so let's take our first question of the day.
Hello. My question concerns administrative rulemaking and interpretive rules. The Supreme Court a while ago decided the Perez case, I think it was Perez v. Mortgage Bankers, in which they said that rules that were interpretive had no deference, and there were some other things in there. But one thing that struck me about this case is that it wasn't Congress at all who declared that contraception was a compelling interest, that it was two steps removed even. It wasn't even the administrative agency itself. Was there anything made of that about what kind of deference or even what kind of force such a rule would have when effectively the statute says nothing on it?
It didn't come up, which surprised me a bit, because Kagan mentioned, well, this was Congress's judgment to do this and this. And no, it wasn't. It actually wasn't Congress who decided this. Congress said preventative services and then delegated that to the agency to figure out what that meant, which they delegated that to a subgroup, which I believe actually had a Planned Parenthood member on it, to decide what counts as preventative services that require coverage. And Justice Sotomayor even made the point and said it's a scientific fact that if you provide contraceptive coverages for free, then you will have these XYZ health benefits and lower abortion rates, et cetera. And I don't think that's actually a fact. I mean, there was the Michael New brief, the amicus brief, which contested that itself. But nobody actually went back to the question of where this mandate actually came from, because it's very unlikely that Congress would have voted for a contraceptive mandate to cover Plan B and Ella and things like that, and to imagine that it actually would have passed Congress had it been explicit. So it does really bring to mind the problems with excessive deference and the problems with rulemaking. And in fact, there was one of the rulemaking point that did come up was from Paul Clement. He said that in the rulemaking, when they came up with this alternative mechanism of enforcement what the administration calls the accommodation, they pointed out that they were exempting the churches and integrated auxiliaries because it was unlikely that their employees would actually use contraceptives. Yet they wouldn't exempt Little Sisters of the Poor, which are nuns. And why would they think that their employees would be any more likely to use contraceptives than churches? So it was essentially making almost a theological judgment, saying that these religious groups really care about the religious faith, but these religious groups, they probably don't care as much. And Paul Clement said that's irrational. And in fact, it's a terrible line to draw when you're excluding clearly, obviously religious organizations as not being religious enough. And there were a lot of Little Sisters of the Poor in the audience as well. So it was a good show and a good representation. And the justice there would have to look them in the eye and say, yeah, we don't think you're religious enough. Justice Kagan, she responded by saying, well, if we go down that route, won't Congress simply not exempt anyone as a result? Because they don't want it to expand so broadly, and you wouldn't want that as an outcome, would you? And Verrilli also said an interesting point. He was countered. I think it was Alito who asked him, are you saying that this alternative mechanism that you're requiring of the Little Sisters of the Poor, you could also require of the churches and the integrated auxiliaries? So no exemption. Could you take away the exemption for the churches as well? And Verrilli said, yes, we could. So that kind of undercut a little bit Kagan's argument as to if you exempt one, exempt all, and because it goes in reverse, then you could take away the exemption from all.
Okay. Did they make much about the compelling interest? Because that just seems – Helen Alvarez has that great article, Law Review article, on the fact that the compelling interest argument is really a sham. Was there any discussion on that?
There was, and a lot of the discussion was on that. And I think that's the tougher ground for the government. As I mentioned, there was less argument on substantial burden than I imagined, a lot less argument, and a lot of it was on the compelling government interest. So Sotomayor was essentially saying that this is about the provision of contraceptives for women to make the flow easily. Verrilli was saying this is about seamless coverage. And he made a very, I think, somewhat new point, I at least not really heard before. He said that doctors that would stop treating patients and stop providing contraceptives and stop even counseling on contraceptives if women were required to get contraceptive coverage on the exchanges. And I found that to be rather puzzling. And Alito asked, why are you assuming that will be the case? Simply because somebody gets supplemental insurance for contraceptives from a different source, that doctors would all of a sudden drop these patients and not counsel them on contraceptives, but if they get one plan, then they'll provide contraceptives. And it does undercut their argument because he stuck to his guns. Verrilli said, yes, it's about keeping it to one plan. We want one plan, seamless, etc., so that these contraceptives flow through easily without obstacles, and women get these without any hassles, which just goes to show, and I think Kennedy jumped in and he said, well, then that means that you're hijacking their programs. And he used the word hijacking. You're hijacking Little Sisters of the Poor's insurance infrastructure. That's your goal. That's what you want to do. That's your interest, as the Chief Justice said. That's what your compelling interest is. You want to actually take their plans. And one more point on that, if I can. The Chief asked mechanically, what actually happens with the nonprofits that object? And Verrilli said, the contraceptive coverage won't appear in their employee brochures. It'll be a separate process where the third-party administrator will contact the people who want the coverage for free and then provide them with their own insurance card and their own separate coverage. So it's essentially parallel coverage. And to which Sotomayor, which surprisingly is just Sotomayor, said, well, how is that any different than if the women actually just went to the exchanges and got supplemental coverage there and got their own card and their own plan? So there might even be an opening, maybe Sotomayor. It was an interesting question coming from her that even she was pressing Solicitor General Verrilli on this point. And so it's got to be one or the other. Either it has to be a single plan and you need to hijack them from the nonprofits, or you're okay with two plans, a supplemental plan, like, as the chief said, supplemental vision and dental. You have a separate card, insurance card for vision and dental. And you could get supplemental plan for pediatric dental, I think it is, under the exchanges already. Why not just supplemental coverage for contraceptives and these drugs and devices in the exchanges? And if you're okay with that, then it just seemed very hard for Verily to get out of that and say that would still be a compelling interest to require the little sisters and others to comply.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got about 30 minutes left. We've got three questions pending, so time for more, I believe. Let's take another call now.
Yes, could you explain what the standards would be for the Supreme Court deferring the decision to next year if they tie in chambers on Friday 4-4?
Yeah, there's a lot of different scenarios could happen. So there could be, if there's a 4-4 split in conference, they could actually issue opinions, and there would be no majority opinion. And if that's the case, it would not have precedential effect, and the rulings below would stand. So you would still have a circuit split. Most of the circuits ruling against the religious nonprofits. That is probably unlikely. And the reason is because they've already issued emergency stays, including Sotomayor. She voted for one, so that the contraceptive mandate wouldn't kick in, even though the lower courts had said it should. Because, logically, the court might decide otherwise. And why are you going to force people to violate their consciences unless you are sure that they're required to? And here, there would be no certainty that they're required to by the court. If it's 4-4, you don't have a majority opinion. And what would happen? Would some of these religious nonprofits move to the Eighth Circuit to avoid the ruling? Or would just get emergency stay after emergency stay? And mind you, there are still other cases in the lower courts working their way up. So you're still going to get a lot of these stay motions coming through. And if they already granted them previously, it would be hard to argue that they shouldn't continue to grant them until they have a majority opinion that would actually be governing law. Because imagine a scenario where they do 4-4, they require the little sisters to violate their conscience, they start paying $70 million in fines, and they shut down. And then the new justice comes along, and they rule 5-4 in favor of the little sisters. And that would just be – I don't think the court would want to be in that sort of situation. And who would vote for that, knowing that there's a chance it could go the other way later? So, but there's a question. I mean, are the four liberals going to hold together when it seems like, you know, Justice Kennedy was fairly stolid in his questioning? And what if you get a majority coming out of this? It's a possibility. So yeah, I think that's the short answer. Is it would be wise for them to hold off on any ruling and keep an injunction in place until they get a majority, just as a matter of fairness.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple questions pending. Let's take another call.
As best you can, how do you count the 8 votes?
Yeah, I don't like to count. I'm bad at arithmetic when it adds up to 5. So it's tough. We know from the previous case it was 5-4, and on the substantive question, and you saw some of that here. Justice Kennedy, who for the conservative side, you would have, because he wrote a separate concurrence in Hobby Lobby, he didn't really show that much hesitation to say that the little sisters have a strong case. Who knows what they're going to do? Justice Kennedy, you know, he keeps his cards fairly close to the vest. He was actually fairly more verbal this time. I think he kind of did indicate sympathy for the little sisters. He asked only some challenging questions of them, and he asked more challenging questions of the government. I mentioned Sotomayor had one challenging question of the government. Most of them were very friendly. Kagan was very friendly to the government, but she was also very quiet as well. So she was, I think, uncharacteristically quiet. So I don't know what you can make of that, but she was far more active, for example, in the Hellerstedt abortion clinic regulation case than she was here. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she was fairly active, fairly hostile to the petitioners, the plaintiffs. Hard to say, and I would rather not hazard a guess, but I just gave you a bit of a flavor of the court. Breyer, in typical fashion, he'll ask a long question and upfront saying, this is not meant to show my hand one way or the other. So he typically does this sort of thing where he asks questions, but he says, don't try to overinterpret it. But he did ask more challenging questions, I think, of the petitioners than the government.
Thanks so much. That's very helpful.
Again, if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've just got one question pending, and our lines are wide open.
One of the things that's bothered me from the very beginning with the media, and even the way that this has been framed today, is that we're only talking about contraception. In the Hobby Lobby case, anybody that read about it would realize that Hobby Lobby really didn't have any objection to contraception. Their objection was to the abortifacients. And this is almost never mentioned in the media, and I think it's given the public kind of a distorted view of quite often what is more at stake, including with the Little Sisters of the Poor.
Yeah, and it doesn't cover just contraceptives. It covers sterilization, Plan B and Ella, which one of the mechanisms is abortion-inducing. It doesn't allow implantation of a fertilized embryo, which the Little Sisters of the Poor and other groups, including Hobby Lobby, cannot countenance because it results in the death of a human life. So this came up when Justice Alito, he asked a question. He said, there's a brief by all sorts of religious organizations, including the Church of Lukumi Babalui, which was the same group that was part of the Lukumi case, which was a free exercise case. And he said, they say this is an unprecedented infringement, a threat to religious freedom. And what do you say to that, Solicitor General Verrilli? And Verrilli said, well, we have all these lower courts that ruled in our favor, and which wasn't a direct answer, but he said it's a balance. And he said it's about fairness to everyone, and the view of the petitioners is not balanced. This doesn't strike the right balance. So Verrilli was going on a balancing tack in response to that. He didn't engage it directly on the merits as to what is the effect of these drugs. And everybody presumed as a given, including the liberals, that these are sincerely held religious beliefs. That was taken off the table right away. This was not an issue debating is there some sham going on with these religious groups? Are they just being obstinate to try to stop coverage regardless of religious beliefs? No, it's actually sincere religious beliefs. The liberals took that and they said it's really the test should be about, is there an effect on third parties? That should be the substantial burden test. If there's an effect on third parties, then the substantial burden equation changes. I don't think that's right. I don't think that is how you could naturally read the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. If anything, that question would come in more at the compelling government interest side. And but they wanted to get it up front, that if it's a third-party issue, then it shouldn't count as a substantial burden. There was some discussion on the citation to a brief cited submitted by Douglas Laycock, who's generally very good on religious freedom. On this case, there's going to be a lot of discussion about his brief because it was mentioned by the liberals in support of their argument. And in some of the writings I've seen afterwards, it's unclear if Douglas Laycock really meant it to be taken that far, what he wrote. So it'll be interesting what happens after that in the fallout of this argument.
Thank you.
Once again, now our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see if others ring in. Roger Severino, let me ask you a question about substantial burden and seriously held religious beliefs. Are those, if you could talk about those two concepts and how they're alike and whether they're the same thing. You mentioned a couple times now that the seriousness of the religiously held beliefs was not really in question. You've also, I think, alluded to the fact that the substantial burden was sort of assumed, at least at the oral argument. Can you talk about those two concepts a little bit?
Yes. So the Breyer in particular was saying, give me a test. Give me an overarching comprehensive test that I could apply here. And counsel demurred. They didn't want to go and announce what a grand theory of substantial burden is. And that's one of the problems with the cases below is that there isn't a consistency about it. But I'm not sure the court is going to rule and issue a declaration of this is what we mean by substantial burden. The Paul Clement came closest to announcing to saying what it would be, and he said it would be the fact that there's a penalty here would be a big part of it. And so it looks as to what are the consequences that are imposed by the government, not so much what is the psychic harm suffered by the religious institution. Because if it's based on the actual spiritual harm that's suffered by the religious institution, then that gets into very dangerous territory because we don't want courts effectively weighing the importance of various religious beliefs. So in this particular case, some organizations might be okay if the government pays for it, but others might not be okay if the government pays for it, if they're still required to be the triggering mechanism that works to open the floodgates for the contraceptives and drugs to flow. Paul Clement said that their three legs are, they're massive fines, this is more than an objection, and this is actually hijacking of a health plan. So if you have those three things, then at least here, this is a substantial burden. That's how you get to substantial burden. On the objection, the liberals were trying to say, isn't this an objecting to objecting? And if it's objecting to objecting, then you can't really call that a substantial burden. There's the Ling case and the Bowen case, which dealt with government doing what government does on its own. And if people are hurt spiritually by what the government does, in the Ling case, it was government acting on its own property. It disturbed Native American burial sites, sacred sites. That was not considered a substantial burden, even though it did cause significant and I'm sure uncontested harm spiritually to those who objected it. They saw it as sacrilege. But in that case, it was a government acting on its own property. And Clement said, this here is more than objecting to objecting. You have the massive fines on top of that, and you have a hijacking of the health plans. And that requires the Little Sisters to do something. It requires action. It requires them, by force of law and compulsion, to do something. And if they object to that thing that they are required to do as a religious matter, then the government really cannot second-guess it. And Kagan said, are you really saying that that's just the end of the matter? The religious institution says it's a substantial burden, end of story. And Paul Clement said, yeah. Pretty much, that's when you have this scenario we have here, then that's how it goes. Now, Breyer raised an interesting point. What about a religious institution that cannot do something it wants to do versus being required to do something it cannot do? What if it's preventing versus coercing, which is comes up in the land use context a lot, which is a different way of looking at it, but that would require a broader substantial burden understanding, and that was not elaborated at the oral argument. But at least petitioners did what they're supposed to do. They said, in this case, this is the test you should apply, and it should extend to this level of protection, and anything beyond that, leave that for another day. Verrilli's response as to what the test should be for substantial burden weighed a lot on the effect of third parties, and maybe confusing with what Verley said and what the justices said, but it was focused on the effect of third parties, and there was less discussion on attenuation than I expected. Was this an attenuated link? Were there too many hoops to jump through to before you get to a substantial burden? But at some point, Verley said, okay, if we assume a substantial burden, then he starts going on the least restrictive means and combating government interest, because he had to get there because he was questioned so much on these other points, and many of the justices wanted to get beyond the substantial burden question and go straight to the government interest and least restrictive means.
Very good. We've got a couple more questions pending. I want to get to those momentarily, but you brought up the idea of attenuation, which was an argument I guess the Supreme Court rejected in Hobby Lobby. I wonder if you could just explain a little bit more about attenuation before we move on to the next question.
Sure. So the four dissenters in Hobby Lobby said that the religious beliefs against the provision of contraceptives was attenuated because the contraceptives were being provided by an insurance plan to employees of the employer, and those employees may or may not actually use the abortion-inducing drugs or devices. And given that it was that far removed, it would be too attenuated to find a substantial burden. And that's what the dissenters were saying in Hobby Lobby. And some of the lower courts, the appellate courts, picked up on that and cast it in a slightly different way, and saying the attenuation here is because it has to do with notice and a form, and then the government starts acting on its own to require third-party administrators, which are kind of like what they sound. They administer the plans or the insurance companies to then provide the coverage in a cost-free way. So they're saying that is an attenuation. That is too many steps removed, and that as a matter of law, it's not a substantial burden because it's too attenuated. The problem with that, of course, is that it is essentially substituting a legal judgment for a theological one. The theological question is, how many steps am I removed before I am complicit in sin? And actually, Chief Justice Roberts used the word sin. Isn't it? You know, they say that no matter how many steps, they say that this requires them to sin. And who are we to say otherwise? And that argument seemed to carry a lot of force, and because of that, you saw Justice Kennedy and others not really push hard on the attenuation point, because I think they were not comfortable jumping in, making theological judgments about these questions.
Okay, let's turn back to our audience now. We've got two questions pending.
On that point of attenuation, I wonder what you think about the argument, and this goes to Doug Laycock's brief. Paul Clement apparently said that, we have to let the religious claimants here unilaterally say whether our religion is burdened or not. But for the legal question of what is a substantial burden in the text of RFRA, we focus instead on what is the dollar amount of the penalty or punishment here, and if it's enough, then we say that's a substantial burden as a legal judgment, but we're not going to touch whether these people, claimants, believe that indirectly they are facilitating sin. Is that distinction, which of course rejects Laycock's point, is that possibly where the court might go here?
Yes, and in Yoder, that was discussed by Paul Clement a bit. That was a case where Amish wanted to homeschool and through age 16, and the fine there, I believe, was $5 a day, and that was still found to be a substantial burden. Even though it seemed to be somewhat of a small amount. And then Clement said, let's stick to Yoder for a little bit, and he expanded. And he said Yoder was a tough case because the government hadn't really exempted all sorts of other religious bodies. Had they exempted the Mennonites and have exempted whatever other religious group, but not exempted the Amish, it would have been a very easy case. And that's why this case is easy here, because the Little Sisters of the Poor are not exempted, but you have churches exempted. You have religious institutions and integrated auxiliaries exempted, but not the Little Sisters of the Poor. They're the ones who have to pay these fines, which are massive. They're not $5 a day. They're $70 million a year. I think it's a year, but $70 million. And that's the problem. That is why you get the substantial burden here. And it kind of sidestepped the attenuation point, and it focused a lot on the penalties, to which some of the liberal justices said, well, then they get to object to everything. And Paul Clement said that's what RFRA does. We're not in Employment Division versus Smith territory anymore. We are now back to what it was before, which was Yoder and Sherbert versus Verner and Thomas, which was also discussed a fair amount. On the attenuation point, so in Thomas they had a objector pacifist who did not want to work in a steel mill forming the steel that was going to be used in shells in war. And there, the attenuation argument is, well, there was no problem there because there was too many third parties that would then mount the shells and then load it into a tank and then send the guy to war and then the tank driver moving in position and then somebody pulling the trigger, and that would be too many steps removed. No, in Thomas they said that's enough of a link to constitute a substantial burden. And the Thomas case was mentioned as well in this precise context. So I take your point, and I think it's a good one that the amount of the penalty was really where the action was today.
We've got one question pending, about 8 minutes left. Let's take another call now.
Yes, putting aside RFRA for a second, was there any discussion or do you have any thoughts on the difference between the Smith-Peyote case where you're prohibited to do something and this case where you're mandated to do something that's contrary to your religious practice?
Yeah, the Peyote case came out in the context of exemptions. So Paul Clement said, there you had a scheduled one drug that was banned, and yet you had an exemption for certain Native Americans to use that exact same drug. Had you banned Schedule 5 versus Schedule 1, then it would be a different scenario. But you banned this exact same drug, provided an exemption for one religious group, and didn't provide it for another. So that really undermines the exemption, and that's the Ocentro case. It really undermines the compelling government interest and even the least restrictive means portions. On the coercion, compulsion versus not compulsion, it didn't come up directly, as I recall. I mean, although it is an important point, the Little Sisters here are required to do something, and they're being penalized because they're not doing what's required of them. And there was some discussion as to what would happen if the government found a way to force the insurers to provide the coverage without the Little Sisters' involvement at all. Would that still be an issue? And then Noel Francisco said, well, it kind of depends on my client, and some clients may object to being forced to enter into a contract with this sort of organization that's going to provide these coverages. But maybe not. It could be a case where that's fine. And Paul Clement said, imagine that there are two forms. One form is a form that the Little Sisters are required to sign that simply says, I object, and then there are no real consequences to them in terms of coverage and flow. And another form that said, I authorize my third-party administrator to provide contraceptive coverage, and that's what is leading to the flow of contraceptives. In that case, in the first case, there'd be no problem signing such a form, but there would be a major problem signing the second. And the government is trying to say it is more like the first and not the second, and the petitioner is saying that it is exactly the second, and that is why it is a problem, because that is the actual compulsion that's being required of them. And that's how they are complicit in an action that they cannot, in good conscience and in good faith, do.
as a follow-up to that, is there any discussion or thought about the fact that people can't come together who have these religious beliefs and form insurance companies to provide coverage that doesn't include these things for those who want to contract with them?
Not directly. So we have, there are grandfathered plans. So it did come up that way, that certain organizations that had these plans that were lucky enough to keep them, kept them. Now, of course, who knew that the government would go to the mat on this question with the religious institutions? And that's what really caught some people by surprise, that the government would really go all the way to Supreme Court to force these organizations, the religious nonprofits, to provide this coverage, when the number of people that would be affected is really small compared to the millions that are already exempted by grandfather plans, by church plans, and by the small business exemption. It almost seems as if the government is making a point that this is what this is about. It's about the government making a point as opposed to truly facilitating the flow of contraceptives to women. Because as the government already admitted, as a justification for the church exemption, employees of religious institutions are some of the least likely to be demanding free contraceptive coverage because these are the ones that would object. So there would be a certain amount of self-selection. You're not going to find ardent pro-abortion feminists working for Priests for Life, for example, which is one of the petitioners. And you have to wonder what is really going on here. And interestingly, on the Priests for Life case, Judge Merrick Garland at the D.C. Circuit, he actually voted against en banc review of the Priests for Life case over a dissent. This is not a mere throwaway en banc denial. This is a case that is right now combined with the Little Sisters and the others that's before the Supreme Court. And Judge Merrick Garland voted no. And the panel had held that there was no substantial burden and Priests for Life lost. So by Merrick Garland voting no, it kind of showed that he would not be a friend to religious liberty if he were appointed on the court. And if the liberals were to hold firm, he could be a deciding vote against the Little Sisters, and which would be bad for religious liberty and for life.
We've got a couple minutes left. We don't have any questions pending. Let me sort of revert to a point you made earlier. I think you've mentioned it twice now, and that at the oral argument, the Solicitor General, Donald Verrilli, was asked whether or not the government had the authority to just sort of erase the exemption for churches and integrated auxiliaries, and he answered yes, that could. And you described, I guess, the reaction from the bench as it related to other matters, but it strikes me, was there any other reaction from the bench? Were people, that seems to me a remarkable thing to say, that the government has the authority to remove even that exemption. Did that strike you as remarkable, or am I off base here?
No, it did, because that came right after Kagan said, aren't churches different? Aren't they special? Didn't we hold in Hosanna Tabor that churches hold a special place in the Constitution, and therefore it's logical for the government to provide exemptions just for houses of worship, etc.? And that argument has some force, and in certain contexts, that might make some sense. The petitioner said, but in this context, it doesn't, because the interest here is making sure you don't violate conscience, and you should only be required to violate conscience if you have this compelling interest behind it. And the mere fact that you're exempting churches cannot save you, because the religious institutions that are not exempt are affected in the exact same way in terms of the governmental interest. The exact same interests are involved with a church as with a religious nonprofit. The exact same religious beliefs are involved as a church and a religious nonprofit. There's just no grounds for making this sort of distinction in this case. But by Solicitor General Verrilli saying, but we could get rid of the church exemption as well, I think that may have surprised Justice Kagan, who it kind of contradicts the point she had just made, that churches are special and worthy of special solicitude. So we'll see how that plays out. It may come back to bite him making that sort of statement. But it does show you that there's an expansive view of federal power and authority even here. And for his sake of trying to be consistent, he made that statement, and maybe we'll see it come up in one of the decisions pointing that out, that that's a very bold position to take, that even if you're a church, that you could lose these exemptions and be forced to participate in the scheme to provide contraceptives and abortion-inducing drugs.
Right. And Hosanna Tabor, of course, decided 9-0 without dissent. It just struck me as sort of similar to a statement Solicitor General Verrilli made about the government's ability to ban a book under McCain-Feingold, a political book. In any event, we've used up our budgeted time here, but let me see if I'm going to assume that this decision will be among the last to come out of the term, so we're looking at late June, I suppose. But let me give you a chance to express any final thoughts or wrap up if you'd like.
Sure. I think Paul Clement, he's great at closing, and I can't do better than what he did. And he said, this isn't a case about conscientious objection. It's about conscientious collaboration, which means the government is requiring the Little Sisters of the Poor to violate their faith when at the end of the day, it's not about the provision of contraceptives. It's not about challenging Obamacare. It is about the government taking a very extreme position, saying that everybody, absent churches, but everybody else must comply and participate in this regime. And we don't care if you think it violates your beliefs. We think it doesn't, or we think it shouldn't, and that should be enough. And I think that's wrong, and it's dangerous for the future of religious freedom if that argument carries a day. I think the government had a hard time explaining that it really did have compelling interests to force the Little Sisters to do this when there were many alternative mechanisms available, when the Little Sisters themselves say they're not going to do anything to stop coverage so long as they have nothing to do with it. And if you could exempt churches so that they have nothing to do with it, then there's no reason not to exempt the Little Sisters of the Poor when all they want to do is serve the elderly poor according to their faith.
Well, my thanks to Roger Severino on my own behalf and on behalf of the Federalist Society. Also, thanks to our callers for dialing in. A reminder to check your emails and the Federalist Society website for our next scheduled telephone conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.